For a long time, we've known we can't believe our eyes anymore. Fake images on the internet have been absolutely lifelike for years. And all that time, in dark corners of the web, have been apps that let us take the faces and perhaps the bodies of friends and enemies, the famous and the beautiful, adults and children, and turn them into porn. But in December last year, those ugly tricks became available to anyone through a chatbot called Grok, available to everyone on X. It's not skilled work. You find a picture and say, put her in a bikini, or show her with bruises, or gagged, or shot, or as close as damn it to absolutely naked. On X alone, in the first 10 days of this year, 3 million sexualized images were made, and 23,000 of them were of children. Elon Musk is essentially unperturbed. He's posted pictures of himself in a bikini. There are many bots now providing this service. Absolutely realistic fake porn is everywhere. Joe Bartosz, who joins me now, is one of the authors of Pornocracy, a new book she co-wrote with Robert Jessel addressing this new reality. Joe, welcome to Late Night Live.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Joe, my reading of your book is that even if all of this whiz-bang new technology were not available, you and Robert Jessel would have profound objections to porn itself.
Yes, yeah, I think that's fair. I think it's very much underestimated as a force that changes how we think, how we relate to one another, and indeed the whole of society. So, yes.
But it's been around forever.
It has. But what we have seen is a revolution in terms of what pornography now is. Not only has it increased in extremity, but as with every other industry, it is competing basically to keep your eyeballs on screen, to keep the data coming in from your clicks, from where you're looking. It's part of the attention economy. It's part of what's known as the fourth industrial revolution. So that's the monetization of essentially what it is to be human. And what's particularly concerning about it is that it's no longer a one-way process. It isn't just a case of looking at something. What you are looking at is looking straight back at you in terms of the data points that are monetized. And it's reshaping our sexuality. So things that used to be very, very niche, so take, for example, the issue of sexual strangulation. That's something that, you know, was unheard of when I was a young woman. It's a very, very dangerous practice. Yet today we know that 53% of young women have experienced that. And that's, say, from my age group and above, that's very, very rare. So what's changed? Well, pornography has changed, and it has changed us individually and as a society, and indeed in the ways that we have sex and relate to one another. And I really sincerely believe it is pulling us apart as a species. It is making us bond to what we're seeing on screen rather than to one another.
Those arguments are familiar to me as an old free speech hack from 30 or 40 years ago, that it is, mm-hmm. Debasing us, that it is ruining our sex lives, that it is ruining our relationships. Now, from 30 or 40 years ago, porn is now immensely more available. But is there proof of the charges you're making here about its impact on us?
Well, I mean, absolutely. So if you want to look at attitudes of young people, or indeed attitude change between the generations, so in the UK in 2024, there was quite a large survey of different age groups, and they looked at attitudes to rape within marriage. Now, it's something that has been illegal in the UK since 1992, and the vast majority of what I'm guessing your generation, so sort of, boomers, understood that in fact rape was illegal within marriage. Now, only 42% of Generation Z, so Zoomers, if you will, understood that that is actually a crime. Similarly, 53% of them, only 53% realised that it could still be rape if she didn't fight back. So what we are seeing is the normalization of really dangerous sexual practices. And the reason they're becoming more normal is because pornography hacks our brains. Online pornography is very, very different. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm no fan of pornography full stop, but online pornography is it has revolutionized how we have sex, and not in a good way. Because men in particular are more inclined to seek novelty in what they're looking, they get bored very quickly. So tastes escalate. So when we were researching the book, we actually discovered that pornography was creating paedophiles. And that sounds extreme, and that sounds like...
It does.
Well, it's absolutely true. So we spoke to several sex offender experts, and one in particular who has been working with sex offenders for decades. And he said that around about 2010, when tube sites became normalized and when high-speed internet connection became sort of a universal thing, if you like, he noticed a new group of sex offender, and it was men who essentially had got bored of looking at mainstream pornography, and they were deeply, deeply ashamed of what they had done, but they had ended up gravitating towards more extreme content. And I mean, that's not entirely surprising, that sort of, you know, that you have to increase the extremity in order to keep men aroused.
But Jo, this seems to be an argument that porn can change sexual orientation. That is an extraordinary claim. I mean, I'm thinking to the situation in Australia, where I think in most states now, efforts to change people's sexuality, in particular to make the gay straight, is now criminalised. You're not allowed to do it because it doesn't work. But you're suggesting that with porn, you could do it. I mean, that might be a very attractive argument for the Catholic Church, for instance.
Well, actually, I think what's vacant, well, as a wider point, and you know, I'm in a relationship with a woman and have been for 15 years. We've been civil partners, so you know, I don't want this to be misunderstood. But when it comes to particularly conversion therapy, I think it's very important to make a distinction between conversion therapy on the basis of sexuality, sexual orientation, and conversion therapy on the basis of gender identity. I think those things are quite erroneously and commonly lumped together. I think they are very different things. Now, when it comes to... I'm so sorry, I'm afraid I've forgotten the question you asked me.
I was once again, not for the first time since we started talking, doubting your argument that you can change people's orientation through porn. I can understand that you can introduce people to new sexual activity, but actually change orientation?
So they admit it. So there's a script writer, so a pornographic script writer, so a coder, called Dylan Rice, and he was caught on in a recording by a journalist a couple of years ago now, basically saying that they introduce, for example, trans characters or gay characters into otherwise heterosexual pornography in an attempt to change the sexual orientation of the watcher. And he said, you know, we just try it out and see if we can get a bigger market with it. And I mean, that's, you know, I mean, to be honest, I suspect all men quite like looking at penises, if I'm honest. they might claim not to, but when there are eye tracking studies, an awful lot of them do gravitate there.
There's a basic competitive instinct in men, of course.
Yeah, that too. But I think, you know, I think that, the idea that I think that's where a lot of homophobia comes from as well. But anyway, that's another matter. So yeah, they have actually said that they do that in order to, or in their terms, to help people explore their sexuality.
That's
helping to shape it. Well, of course it is.
Yeah, but you know, shaping and exploring are completely different. But you're arguing for shaping.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you know, otherwise, we wouldn't have these sort of, well, firstly, we wouldn't have very, very niche genres of pornography, which are then enacted out in public life. So, for example, furries. I don't know if you've seen the sort of explosion of furries where you are. It seems to be a global phenomenon. And there's a huge amount of furry pornography. Now, furries themselves might say that they are exploring their identities, that they are... and that, you know, there's a, most of them do indeed use pornography. There was a fact, a huge gay crossover as well. Most of them are gay men. But it's also clearly something that they feel is something they've explored through what they're watching. I would actually say that there's nothing innate about that. That is something that is created, and that is an identity that has been created from what they are watching online. Yeah.
Really, I mean, the word on furries in this country is, for the most part, it's bullshit. You know, you hear about these things, but it's not actually happening. Joe, one of the things, you know, that the argument against porn is always that it will turn us into sexual, you know, uninhibited performers of sex. But there's a fascinating statistic in your book from the U.S. Center for Disease Prevention that shows that the percentage of high school students who've had sex has dropped in the last sort of 10 or 15 years. Now, do you put that down to porn? I mean, it's remarkable. It counters all the arguments that I've heard about, you know, unleashing unbridled sexuality. Why has this happened?
Oh, no, I mean, I don't think there's anything about unleashing sexuality when it comes to pornography. As I say, I think it corrupts it and it shapes it. Now, when it comes to the drop in people having sex, that's entirely concordant with, that's exactly what you would expect when people are spending more time looking at pornography and spending time online than actually relating to one another. So part of my objection to pornography is that it actually stops people having sex. It stops them exploring their innate sexuality, enjoying who they are, because it hijacks that. It takes it away from us. There's nothing liberatory about it in the slightest. Now, when it comes to the UK situation, I can tell you that 14% of men admit every week that they look at pornography. Only 11% of men are having sex that frequently, once a week. So, I should have said that was once a week. So what we are
seeing, 14% are watching pornography once a week.
Yep.
Only 14. What are we worried about? That's, you know, that's if I could do my maths. That's what's that 80 something who aren't.
Well, no, it's so far as monthly visits go, it's around about 10 million men a month, 3 million women a
in
month.
Britain.
So yes, in the UK. So actually, it's a fairly significant number, and I think it is very, very concerning. When it comes to, you know, people are sort of starting to worry, obviously, about population decline, and you think, well, of course there's population decline, because people are literally falling in love with what they are seeing on screen. They are displacing people for pixels. It is such a fundamental shift in human sexuality. We really need to start taking it seriously, because it is ripping people apart at the sort of relational, emotional level.
Say it, Joe. Say it. People are masturbating. People are masturbating, in your view, instead of having sex. Is that the argument?
Well, I wouldn't care if they were just masturbating, but they are masturbating to images that in any other circumstances would be crimes.
I'm speaking to Joe Bartosz, journalist, assistant editor at The Critic, and co-author of Pornocracy. Joe, let's get to the situation of this homemade stuff.
Yes.
Elon Musk doesn't seem to be particularly perturbed about X being used for this purpose. Has he done anything whatever in response to the uproar that Grok has caused?
I mean, other than sort of mildly mock the people who have complained, not really. I mean, and that's not surprising, because in the same week as he's exposed for generating essentially, you know, revenge porn, child sexual abuse imagery, you know, with through Grok, he raised $20 billion from investors. I mean, this was always about money. Once again, it's nothing about freedom of speech or liberating sexuality. It is about money. So, of course, he doesn't care.
And the photograph of himself that he concocted, he's standing there in a bikini, looking quite reasonably fit. large bulge. He's you know, putting himself out there to be quite attractive.
Well, if you like that sort of thing, I guess. The point about that is male nudity and female nudity are very different things. And how
explain.
What has been used.
Explain the difference between female and male nudity.
Well, essentially, men rape women. I mean, it's that basic. The fact is, you know, when you have a woman who's naked, she's vulnerable. When you have a man who's naked, he's a threat. That is a sort of primal, very obvious difference. So I think for him to sort of disingenuously claim that it's the same for him to be sort of stood there in a bikini as it is for, the men who are, and it is largely men who are online putting female politicians into dental floss bikinis, having them covered in donut glaze, which is obviously supposed to look like semen, having sort of bruises on their faces, all of these horrific things that we have seen happen. Having doing that is very, very different from ha-ha, let's laugh at Musk in a bikini. And I think eventually there was a risk that it could force women out of public life.
Has the government in Britain shown any willingness to contest this disgusting misuse of people's images?
Yes. We've got Ofcom in the UK have attempted to hold Musk to account, hold Grok to account. And I think, you know, you've got essentially now there seems to be this, who are we more scared of? Tech companies who are essentially monetizing our very sort of human nature, if you like, or our government, who I also don't trust. You know, we're sort of in this impossible situation. And once again, I am terribly sorry, but I'm afraid I've forgotten the question you asked me.
You've answered it superbly. But I wonder whether the experience in Britain is like the experience in Australia, where laws can be passed against outfits like X, et cetera, but they are not necessarily enforced.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I sort of think in a way we have enough laws in the UK. So we have the Online Safety Act, which has been very successful. It's brought in age verification. There are discussions at the moment, as I believe there are in Australia as well, which just happened in Australia, about restricting young people's access to social media and smartphones. And I think, you know, the things, they can't be disconnected because of the way, particularly that sites like OnlyFans work, you end up with social media being absolutely flooded with pornography. So because they have to drive traffic to their sites because they're essentially self-employed, if you like. So I can see that actually, you know, we have made some significant steps in the right direction. And I think if we were to just bloody enforce the laws that we have, that would make a huge difference. So, you know, we've had four different laws over the past sort of few decades against extreme pornography. And yet it is still the majority of what's out there. We need to just enforce them.
If somebody finds that there's an image of themselves up there that has been warped and turned into porn, is there a mechanism for them to get it down in Britain?
No, not at the moment. I mean, it depends. I think it depends on... I think if you'd walk into your average police station and try and get them to take it seriously, they'd just laugh at you. It's just not really. I mean, technically, probably, in practice, no.
But there needs to be a specialised force for this kind of thing, doesn't there? Not a local police station.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, it's essentially most crime now happens online. And that's sort of part of my argument around, I think the online world is a wonderful thing, but it was built for adults and it was built, I think, particularly by and for adult men. And I think that's reflected in the sort of foundational values of the online world, if you want. And if we do want children to take a part of that in particular, we need to start policing it in the same way as we do any other public space. That's why I don't necessarily think it's about freedom of speech. I think it's just about sort of creating a civilization online in the same way as we have offline.
I was on Instagram today, and I'm a bit of a fan of Instagram, and there was an image of Oscar Wilde turned into real life. You know, this famous image of Wilde took a breath and began to quote Wilde, and it was utterly lifelike. And I wonder whether a time will come when we just no longer trust our eyes and know this is fake, and whether that will change the dynamics of everything you're talking about.
I think there's a difference between knowing and feeling. I think there might come a point where we know it. I think we're already becoming very sort of, we're already starting to question what we see, which is, obviously a good thing. But I think just the parts of your brain that are reached, particularly the parts that sort of come alive when you look at pornographic content, I think it's much harder. I think that sort of bypasses conscious thoughts. It bypasses all of those safeguards that we might put up in our minds. So actually, I think there's an army of technologists out there keeping us online, particularly when it comes to pornography, which is obviously such a huge industry. So I think we are kind of fighting a losing battle against them, if I'm honest.
And we don't care if it's fake or not, I suppose. If it gives pleasure, ba-boom, let's watch.
Yeah, well, I mean, I also was interesting when AI-generated content started to be discussed in the mainstream, everybody was talking about political fakes. Well, actually, at the time, and I think it's still the case, 99% is pornographic. That's it's always the industry that pushes these sorts of technologies forward because men's sexuality is very easy to hijack. You're emotional creatures.
Joe, on that, I think we should part. Joe,
okay.
Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cheers. I have been speaking to Joe Bartosz, journalist, assistant editor of The Critic, co-author of Pornocracy, which has just been published by Polity. This is Late Night Live.